Web 2.0 program chair John Vitale talks to two venture capitalists about investing in technology. Ram Shriram focuses on the small seed angel round of funding. He invested in Stickit, which was announced at the launch band. He also invested in Google a number of years ago. Roger McNamee's investments take content businesses and try to connect them directly to their audiences. This podcast is brought to you by the Intel Software Partner Program. Imagine a world technology leader as your partner, your business partner, your development partner, your marketing partner. Get an advantage in the Intel Software Partner Program. Join today at intel.com/partner. Here are Ram Shriram and Roger McNamee with Web 2.0 Summit Program Chair John Vitale.
The next conversation we're going to have, these two folks probably don't need any introduction. Matter of fact, I'm going to let them introduce themselves because they are both very well known in the Valley. They have taken some very interesting positions, one side being large private equity, mezzanine-sized, lots of zeros, and the other small seed angel, not so many zeros. One of them happened to turn into an awful lot of zeros, but we'll get into that. So please join me in welcoming Ram Shriram and Roger McNamee. Come on up, guys. Ram? You guys can sit here. Roger, how you doing?
See ya.
So, I guess the first thing I want to ask you guys is just to tell me what you're up to. What do you do? What do you do all day, Ram?
Well, Stickit just launched at Launchpad here, I think, Tuesday.
And you were an angel investor in Stickit?
Yes, and I think it's a cool new productivity app. This is the future. It's a little Ajax app that... is a web-based productivity app, much like many others that you are seeing now and you're likely to see others.
Now, you invested about 8-9 years ago in a little productivity search app called Google as an angel.
Right.
How'd that work out?
Pretty good. Well, we need others.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. So you focus on the small sort of seed angel round of finance.
Yeah.
Roger?
So my focus is on trying to take content businesses and connect them directly to their audience. I don't know about you guys, but I live in a world where I just don't have enough time for all the things I want to do. And it's my sense that whether you're looking at journalism, whether you're looking at music, whether you're looking at video games, or any kind of online or any kind of real content, that technology has totally disrupted the business model of the media industry. Those guys have absolutely no clue what to do about it. And the world needs somebody to align themselves with the creators of content and with the audience and to take it to the next level. So I'm to a specific thing, the most recent investment we've made, we bought a big piece of Forbes. And the goal there is to reinvent business journalism. 10-year time horizon. We've invested about $250 million. And we think over 10 years, we're going to help everyone in this room and everyone else in the world deal with the fact that they have to make really important decisions. They got like 100 things in their inbox. Two of them are actually important, and nobody can figure out which two. And our job is to figure out over the next 10 years how to help you find the two that really matter.
So you just said $250 million. What's the average size of your investment, Ram?
It can range from $100,000 to less than $1 million. Today, to start an internet venture has never costed less money than it does today. Commodity hardware, open source software, small development team. I actually don't look for a business member of the team early on. I think the business model can be invented as you go. So I truly think that the threshold or the barrier to entry for starting a young internet business has never been lower. The cost of failure, therefore, is also very low. Mm-hmm. Other than, it's hard to find talent, and the energy you need to put into it needs to be 110%.
Right, right. Now, just before we go any further, I want you guys to know that because we have these two guys on stage, and I know that about 40% of you out there are entrepreneurs, I really encourage you to come to the microphones and make this more of an interactive dialogue. So at any time something strikes you, just come up to the mics and we'll bring you in, please. So pretty small size investment, really early, lots of money, getting a big brand like Forbes and figuring out pretty much the same thing. How do I take a big brand like Forbes and sort of turn it into something that...
So if you think about the difference in the problems we're trying to address, in many ways, ROM's going after individual needs that people have with a very specific solution that can be addressed with technology. And we're going after things that where the content is the issue rather than the technology. And so there are issues of trust and authority that come into this. If you're going to make a decision on buying a home or you're going to make a decision on investing your capital, you're not going to do, you know, a tool is important, but it's only a step. What you really want is somebody to help you make those decisions, and you're not going to rely on somebody you don't trust, and you're not going to rely on somebody who's not authoritative. Mm-hmm. So building a brand from scratch in those areas is very hard to do and takes a tremendous long period of time. I think it's going to take us 10 years in the case of Forbes to do this new model of journalism, and I think if you're trying to do it from a startup, you'd have to count on something wildly longer than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, I've done a few of those content startups.
Yeah, no, and so have I. And
one of them's still around.
Yeah, no, and a lot of mine are still around, but you know, they were all a lot harder work than I would have liked, and none of them is as big as I would have hoped.
Right. Now, both of your models strike me as not at all like what you might consider traditional venture capital models. And there are a lot of VCs in the audience. I mean, of those of you that are in the venture, how many of you consider yourselves traditional? Yeah, I was a setup. But really, there is a very well understood traditional venture capital model, and you know, we have Mike Moritz. Rom sits on the board of Google, and Mike Moritz is also on the board, and John Doerr, and these are some of the traditional powerhouses of venture capital who you know, work in the deal range of $5 million to $20 million, and that's and when they come to folks like Rael Dornfest, who's launching Stickit, you know, and Rael says $5 million would be great. Can I take $100,000 of it for my business and spend the other $4.9 million on, you know, food? Because they don't know what to do with that kind of money. Is this model imperiled? Or is this model threatened?
Well, I don't know if it's imperiled, but I think if you take $5 million when you need less than $1 million to actually successfully launch a business, I think you end up sort of making mistakes. It's a problem of too much money, and I'd rather see startups be scrappy, frugal, nimble, on a lean diet of ramen noodles and not expensive food. So I just think. I think it's important to have that sort of laser-like focus on, even if it's a feature, at some point that feature can expand to contiguous areas that then becomes a product, and you have to build a beachhead. So in Stickit's case, it's to-do lists, it's a little notepad application that's sort of universal across different applications on the internet.
If you think about the challenge of venture today, it's that the funds are pretty big. And as you say, they typically want to put $5 or $10 million into the first round, $25 million over the life of the investment. And they often do these things in tandem with another firm. So one of the challenges is that a lot of the money winds up going to places that can actually use that kind of capital as opposed to going into the most attractive ideas. Because a lot of the most attractive ideas only need something less than $1 million. Mm-hmm. And it's... That's a different game plan. You know, those guys, what they need is ROM, right? They don't need a venture capitalist. They need somebody who knows what he knows. Mm-hmm. And that it is a different skill set. And in the angel market, you know, there are guys who dabble, right. And then there's a really small number of people. And anybody who doesn't know this guy, I mean, this is a totally different ballgame we're talking about here. Okay?
Thank you. Thank you for that commercial. But I would say the following, which is also the math doesn't work today if you are going to put out a lot of $5 to $10 million investments from a $500 million fund. The challenge ends up being, how do you ultimately produce many more YouTube-type successes? And my belief is there are going to be few and far between that are either exits through M&A or exits through IPO greater than $1 billion. There will be a lot of companies that are bought in the sub $100 million range, And that really means there's huge pressure on that IRR model that everyone is trying to aim for that higher and bigger
right.
number. And there's also a problem of now too much money. So I think if you're entrepreneurs in this room, it's wonderful because if you have an idea, you could raise money. You will never go short of money. And if you have a really good idea and a great team, you probably can go to an auction model and raise a lot of money. So then comes the challenge. So don't equate raising money to success. The next stage is then how do you sort of grow from there? The challenge is if your value keeps going up in these valuations with venture capital money that you're raising, eventually your exit becomes expensive. And there's only six or seven guys out there that can buy your company. There are three or four sort of media companies, and there's three or four large internet companies. So you then have to, you know, sort of figure out how to sell it at a price that is either lower than your last venture round, or if you're able to, you know, build a good enough business, then you would get a multiple of that.
Yeah. Hang on one sec. I want to bring in this question since I did promise to let these guys in.
Hey, Roger and Ram. My name is Ryan Carson from DropSend.com and Carson Systems. And we built our web app for about $75,000, and we're in the process of selling it right now. And Roger, I understand from your model there's plenty of companies that need hundreds of millions of dollars to do what they need to do. But Ron, my question's more for you. You know, we didn't, $75,000 isn't much, and you know, we launched it and it seemed successful and we're gonna sell it for, you know, a multiple that's many times that. And I just, why, besides your experience and your connections, why do we need you? Can you help me understand that?
Very good question. You don't need me. I think most people that can actually sort of bootstrap and build a business and can get to that early validation. The beauty of building a consumer internet venture is it's about making sure that when you launch and you build your field of dreams, if the users come, then it's half the battle won. Then you need to go figure out a business model. But if the users don't come and you're not user-centric enough to have that focus to say, how do I get those users in, not just day one, but over a period of time, and keep them there, then that's the challenge you got to work on, not figuring out who you want to take money from. That's less important.
If I can make just an observation both about venture and about entrepreneurial opportunities for those of you who are doing it. First thing to keep in mind is that in any endeavor, whether it's the investment business or entrepreneurship in general, you don't want to be doing the same thing as 25 other people. And so when you talk about traditional venture, the biggest problem here is that if you're undifferentiated in venture, you have the same problem as if you're undifferentiated on the web. You really need to have some unique position. So when I say we invested $250 million in Forbes, they're not going to spend $250 million of our money to do something new. A big part of that was buying a very large, substantial, a piece of a large, substantial company. But there is real money, real capital available to do what they need to do. But it's a web business, you know, and we do it all the same way any other web business does. And it's all on open source stuff with really good people doing it. And the thing that I would encourage you to think about as you start up is, you know, Ram's talking about how you get people to your site and keep them there. There, I believe there's a whole untapped market, which is part of what we're going after, which is the person who doesn't have the time to go to your site. I mean, let's think about this for just a minute. There are two really compelling things going on right now. The first thing that's going on right now is user-generated content. You know, if you listen to media guys, they all tell you this is the appetizer and eventually people are just going to watch Hollywood movies. I think that's bullshit. I mean, to me, user-generated content is about self-expression. This is an alternative to passive entertainment. I think it's going to gain for at least the time period that the current generation is driving through the Python. And, you know, the reality is the amount of really cool stuff going on to service that market is really limited. And so, to me, if I were doing a content business today as an entrepreneur, I'd be looking at things that enabled new and cooler forms of user-generated content. Second thing that's going on is this issue of time. As I said earlier, everybody's got 100 things in their inbox, and they probably got three or four inboxes. If you were to let everything go for 6 months, you would discover that 98 of the 100 items just go away. They just don't matter. The problem is that the two things that really matter, it's really hard to tell what they are ahead of time. If you can help people figure out what those two things are, you are going to be very rich. That's the market I'm in with Forbes and Move.com. In the video game business, we're in the market of helping people move towards user-generated content and towards using their time in a more fun way. But I think those two aspects of time, saving people time on the one hand and helping them make better use of the time they have on the other, those are the two big themes I'd focus on.
We have another question over here.
Thanks. Hi, it's David Fox from The Astrologer. Maybe we can help you find those two things. I just want to say thanks for stating the value of authoritative content. You know, in this rush to user-generated content, there is real value in authoritative content. And it costs money to put authoritative content together. So I just want to state that.
I agree.
It does. And I'll tell you something. It drives me crazy what we're seeing in the media business today. The newspaper industry has an average profit margin of 24%. Not because that is the natural profit margin, but because that's what you can get if you harvest those businesses. There's not a major city daily paper in America that couldn't be growing today if it ran on much more normal margins. But all these guys are harvesting these things. It just drives me crazy. Because, look, none of us, I mean, the notion that you're going to depend on Yahoo or Google for your news, I mean, you know, you can get that for data that's happening in real time, but you can't run your life off of real-time news services. You know, every once in a while, you need somebody to give you a perspective.
Can I ask you guys, in both your cases, it seems very clear, if you look at the last 2 years, that you mentioned seven companies, you know, there maybe there's eight. So every so often one shows up that you didn't think would do something, like the Times, and they buy About.com or something like that for $400 and some odd million. But generally, there's a pretty well understood set once you get to a size. The IPO market is closed for young, aggressive, successful, interesting startups who may only have, you know, two or three quarters of profits. I mean, even if that is the case. Is it closed because the markets don't want it, or is it closed because the markets are terrified of what happened to them the last time, or is it closed because the entrepreneurs don't want to go public?
Well, let's understand the current state of things. There is a lot of money for private funding of young companies, but the public markets, so this is the difference between the bubble and now, the public markets are very clear that they're only going to support businesses that truly have profits and that have growth. So two companies have gone public in the last 6 months, and it's quite, kind of instructive to see how they performed. One was Shutterfly, and the other was eHealth Insurance. Both of them are sub-$500 million companies. We live in this era of Sarbanes-Oxley, where companies that are less than $1 billion in market cap don't get enough coverage from analysts, and therefore they sort of languish in some sense. So it's almost better, unless you're going to be able to build a larger business, to seek an exit that is through M&A, which is one of the reasons why I fear there aren't going to be too many over $1 billion public companies, at least that I can see, in the short term, in the next 12, 18 months. This could, of course, change if the sentiment of the public markets were to change. But that's the situation as it exists this moment.
Now, is your exit with Forbes after 10 years, of course, I'm assuming, right? The public markets?
Who knows? I mean, I spent 20 years managing funds that had at least some component of them in the public market. And, you know, there are phases and cycles. And right now, fear dominates. But eventually, greed will come back. I'm not... No, here's the thing. Look, fear is transitory. Greed is permanent. That's the one thing you can count on. The thing I'd tell you is that I don't worry about my exit. I only worry about the things I can control. If we execute our strategy well, the exit will take care of itself. We're in the transformation business. We're not actually a private equity fund. We have a private equity structure. But private equity funds are about extracting cash from excess capacity in the economy. We're about trying to transform...
Well, and you've done that before.
No. My Silver Lake was also a transformation fund. The Silver Lake today is a private equity fund, but the first fund, the one I was involved in...
I may have misunderstood the first fund.
Yeah, I mean, right. You know, we did Seagate and Gartner and a whole bunch of other things that really were being transformed in a very positive way, Ameritrade. So I really believe that when you look at something like the media business, there's a real audience. People desperately need to be entertained, and they need information. And they need it in a lot better form than they're getting it today. Everything is mass market today, right? Yep. Even Forbes. I mean, we have 900,000 circulation in the magazine, 16 million monthly uniques on the website, and we target mass markets.
Right.
Well, guess what? 10 years from now, we're going to try to build a relationship with you that allows us to personalize the stuff so that it solves your problem. I mean, a year ago, I don't know if any of you guys, actually, people here are really smart, so you probably didn't have this, but if you had a five-year balloon arm, a year ago, what you needed was somebody to grab you by the collar and say, stop whatever it is you're doing and go and refinance your mortgage. And the problem is there was nobody to do that.
Yeah.
Well, sometime in the next 10 years, either Move or Forbes or both is going to solve that problem for you. And, you know, we're going to have to build a higher level of trust. And to the fellow from the Star Ledger, we're going to have to, you know, have the authority
right.
to be able to do that. And that's hard work. It'll take a lot of money. And if we do a good job,
it'll take care of itself.
It'll take care of itself.
Question over here.
Hi. Is this on? My name is Lara Hansen. I'm a graduate student from New York City, also an entrepreneur. I have a college website launching this weekend, the College Voice. My question to you, my friends and I have been bootstrapping this project. We've talked to some VCs, but my concern is figuring out valuation. And also, how do you not get kicked out of your company once you go to a VC? Because that's my biggest concern.
Good concern. I'd say that would be crazy for anyone to kick the founders out of their own business, because if anybody has passion for the business that they're building, it's got to be the founders. So unless there is an issue of ethics or an issue of lack of commitment that happens post the funding or something, unless there's some dynamic that causes that problem to be such a bad issue that they'd have to, you know, eject a founder, I would say that would be the last thing that any investor would think of. And that includes anybody that's out there investing. However, as far as valuation, I wouldn't get too hung up on it. I think you want to decide what value are you seeking from that investor. Do you need just their money, in which case, take dumb money. If you already think you know how to go build your business with respect to the partnerships you need, the people you need to hire, and all of that. If, on the other hand, you need smart money, then figure out what are the things that you need help on, and is that investor going to be able to provide that help for you?
Can I add one thing to that? And this is a really important point. I'm a huge believer that what matters is the size of the pie, not the size of the slice. And most entrepreneurs actually have some difficulty judging whether they need smart money or not. I've always believed in my own. I've started three businesses, and each time I've made the choice to bring in all of the resources I could possibly bring in to make it successful. You know, kind of a belt and suspenders thing. I won't talk about the percentage of my first business that I gave to Kleiner Perkins, but it was very large. But I had the opportunity in 1991 to be partners with John Doerr inside his office for the next 12 years. And the fact that I gave away too much of the business on the first round turned out to be immaterial because the pie got so big, who cared? And I would just tell you, if you fixate on the percentage of the pie that you own, give it up now. There's no point. You're going to have to be so lucky to make it work if that's what you're worried about.
Well, wait a minute. I've started a few businesses too. Stay over 51 as long as you can if you want to control your business.
Yeah, but hang on. I just think this notion of controlling the business is ridiculous. Look, at T. Rowe Price...
Do you remember the industry standard?
Hang on. I do. And hang on. And fair point.
I mean, so maybe it's an outlier example.
But hang on. I just want her to understand that I'm not just saying this out of self-interest. At T. Rowe Price, I was the only guy. When I started Integral, I had one partner plus Kleiner Perkins. At Silver Lake, three partners. At Elevation, five partners. So my percentage has shrunk every single time, okay? Now, you sit there and you go, wait a minute, I'm the only common element among all those things. Why does my percentage keep shrinking? And the reason is because I'm less interested in failure each time, and I'm putting in the insurance policy to avoid that. You have to make your own choice in this. As Rom said, if your judgment is you can get away with dumb money, that's great. But the number of people who've had great ideas that have failed with dumb, because they took dumb money, unfortunately exceeds the number of people who had great ideas, who took smart money, and then, you know.
Do you mind if I ask a follow-up question then?
Sure.
How do you determine who is the smart money?
You're looking at it. Look on my right, your left, okay? That's the definition of smart money. My own judgment of how this thing works, I think it's very situational. People tend to look at the firm first and the person second. My view is it's all about the person and the situation. Somebody who's brilliant in one situation is not going to be as good in something else, right?
Yeah,
I mean, you go back, John Doerr was responsible for Penn Computing, right? He's had bad days. I've had a bunch of serious clunkers. Rom's never had one. Everything he's done...
That's not true. that's not true. Here's how I would answer it, which is that I agree with Roger. Don't look at the brand name of the firm. That matters less. Look at the person in the firm who's likely to work with you or who's sponsoring your deal or is excited about you. And do you respect that person? Do you feel that they could sit down with you and actually help you? And that's a judgment call you have to make. And when you make people judgment calls, even to this day, I make mistakes. So.
Yeah, but this is the essence of entrepreneurship. Making judgments about people is the single most important thing a founder does.
Absolutely.
You have to make judgments about your team, and guess what? Your investors are part of that team. And you should not view them as an externality. The way I think about it is this the person who at 2 o'clock in the morning I want to call, whether I have good news or bad news?
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
If it's bad news, I call them because I think they're the person best able to help me. And if it's good news, I'm just so overjoyed I want to call somebody, and they're the one who at 2 o'clock in the morning won't mind
that
I've called
with good
news.
Yeah. Question over here.
Hi, I'm with Replica. We agree with this thesis that it's about discovering unique information for people and really narrowing it down to deliver to people what's the best that they can have. The problem with that, in our case, and the question I have, I actually have two questions, is that when we got into this, it's a very serious problem. It's a supercompute problem. It's, it's not something that's easily solved. And so we couldn't start a company for, $5,000 and a couple of pizzas. And so the technology underlying what we did, we had to license it, and then we needed a really good team. So question is, we ended up putting the money in. Fortunately, myself and another guy were able to do that. But where do people go that need to get to money pretty quickly? Like people who might not have a technology that they can, develop for $10,000. And do you think that this model of the web currently with just that, hey, $75,000, and I've got an application, does that stifle innovation? And are VCs really investing mainly in the communities? Because even now, it wasn't really until ETRE in Barcelona where the VCs really started to get what we were doing. And so that's my question. Is it stifling innovation? And do you really think that like these technologies are defensible and good investments over time? Because one of the pieces of our project is the way that we deliver information. And I don't want to get into saying what that is right now, but what's wild about that for me was that we duplicated what other companies are using as their platform in like 30 days. And so I'm just curious as how you see that.
So I want to make sure I understand that question. Where do people go if they don't have the same model that we've been talking about, which is disrupting, but might need somewhere between 5 and 15? Can everybody in the audience who's willing to do that raise your hand? I mean, there's a lot of people, I think, that are looking for that opportunity. Am I wrong?
Yeah, no, I don't think you will find any shortage of capital if that's what you need in order to feed your business or your idea or your innovation engine inside your company. So I don't think the market at the moment, at least in terms of company formation and in terms of new funds that have raised money outside of the bubble period, this is the highest it's ever been. So I'd be very surprised if almost any idea doesn't get funded at this time.
No,
which is a little bit of an issue because it's not a bubble, but it's frothy. So therefore, I would not say that that's going to be an issue for you.
Well, let me drill.
I don't think it is, but just the point is that it's really, I mean, at least it wasn't my experience that it was that easy, because we have a really, I think, a very strong management team. We have, success under our belt. And when we went to some VCs early on, I guess it was probably too early. That's what they were telling us anyway. And so finally we just got frustrated and said, okay, let's put in the money and start getting this thing rolling. And I didn't find that that was the case, that, hey, you could have a really good technology, which NASA is using literally, and, you know, and get the money like that.
Frame of reference is flawed, okay? The key thing here is the more value you can add before you take outside money, the bigger the piece of the company you're going to own. I mean, this is to that woman's question. You want to maintain a large share, do a lot of development before you get any outside money. And Here's the thing. It may have been in how you presented it. It may have been that the people you were talking to were getting divorced. I mean, who knows? No, I'm serious. I mean, this is not easy, nor should it be easy, okay? I mean, I've started 3 businesses. Not one of them was easy. And, you know, you've been involved in a million things. These things, it's just hard work. And if that's not exciting to you, you should be doing something else. I mean, my simple thing is, if you've got an idea that you are so passionate about you can't think about anything else, do that. But if you can think about anything else, do that instead.
Yeah. Entrepreneurship
is not for lightweights.
Yeah, thanks. That's my
Over here.
Hi. Austin Hill. Hey, Roger. Question for you. You mentioned trusted media sources with Forbes and entertainment and gaming, but I also know you have an interest in music and you have partners involved who are involved in music. How do you see the future of media relating to music or movies where trust may not be as relevant as just the entertainment value and obviously the issues with DRM? Where do you see that kind of media play?
I'll go in reverse order. So DRM to me stands for doesn't really matter. I believe trust actually matters a lot. I believe that fans do not rip off the creative people that they like. If you're a fan of a musical artist, you know, you respect that that's this person's living. If you are a real fan of a director or whatever, you're probably not going to steal their stuff. I mean, unless you're totally destitute. And our view of this whole thing is that it's all about relationships. In contrast to the fellow with the NASA application, we're not looking for things where technology is a solution. We're looking at technology as a delivery platform, but our stuff's about human creative endeavor and human editorial. And, you know, we have been working very hard on music for a long time. It's a hard problem. I believe it is currently easier to solve the problem with MOVE and Forbes, which is to say addressing, you know, the finance side of people's lives, simply because the business managers in those businesses are more ready for change. Music industry's just been getting hammered, and the people are terrified, and it's harder. But we'll be there, and you know, we'll be in a bunch of these other categories. This is important stuff, you know, right now those businesses are being run by people who are harvesting them.
And for those who don't know, one of the partners, what the questioner was referring to is one of the partners in Elevation is Bono. How'd you pull that off, by the way?
It was his idea. It was pretty easy. No, I mean, he came to me with the idea. And, you know, he knows a lot of people in the investment business, but I was the only one he knew who liked music. So, now, basically, you know, here's a guy who
I've seen his band a couple times. He's pretty good.
He spends a lot of time, as you know, on humanitarian and endeavors. And the band basically said to him, can you take a piece of that energy and apply it to fixing the problems of the music business? It was a good question. And here we are 3 years later, and we still haven't got the answer.
Microsoft really has the answer. Problems. It's called Zune.
Well, yeah, you know, maybe it is, maybe it's not.
We our time is up. We have a lot of questions. I'll tell you what, you guys, okay, we go out into the hallways there, sure, and answer questions for them. All right, well, thank you very much for coming.
Hey, John, thanks for a great time.
Ram Shriram and Roger McNamee at the Web 2.0 Summit 2006. This podcast is brought to you by the Intel Software Partner Program. Imagine getting to market faster with a world technology leader as your partner. Get your applications to market faster as a member of the Intel Software Partner Program. Fuel your success with access to new Intel platforms and technologies, world-class engineering resources, and effective ways to market and sell your solutions. From strategic planning and product development to marketing and sales, Membership in the Intel Software Partner Program brings you new opportunities to benefit every aspect of your business. Are you ready to accelerate your business success? Join the Intel Software Partner Program today at intel.com/partner.